podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Sword and Laser, episode number 96. I'm Veronica Belmont.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
And this is the show where we talk about the latest in science fiction and fantasy books that we are either reading or just discussing, go over all the discussion topics happening over on Goodreads.com, talk a little bit about our new video show, and also kick off the show with a little segment we call What Are We Drinking?
I suck at What Are We Drinking this week, because I'm drinking water because I'm fighting a cold.
I should be drinking water.
I'm drinking pure whiskey.
Are you just trying to be tough now?
Yes, I'm drinking water.
I'm drinking a 2006 Bruno Rocca Barbaresco. I'm not drunk. I'm exhausted.
I was drinking
today.
A lot of it too.
I'm so tired. I came home after shooting Texilla and I just took a nap. I almost never do that in the middle
of the day. There's a cold going around. Don't get it.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's what I have.
Yeah. Well, folks, if you haven't listened to our show before, we really missed you. We're glad you finally made it.
We're glad, yeah. We've been waiting for you.
We've been waiting for this
all this time.
Welcome.
But we usually also kick off the show with the quick burns.
A teacher in a middle school in South Carolina has been placed on administrative leave for reading the Ender's Game.
This is a long and convoluted story. Now, we should have talked about this last week. And in fact, I think the story has been happening consistently for the past few days.
Yeah, about the time that we were recording, it was breaking last week. So we've had a week to kind of get in on this. Essentially, a parent reported to the school district complaining that the book was pornographic. Some adult-ish
material. There's nothing pornographic in the book.
There's nothing pornographic from my community standards, but maybe from this person's community standards. Anyway, it's not any more adult than many other things that one reads in high school. But
there is some confusion to exactly what the parent is talking about from what I've read on the different sources. Some people are saying that the teacher was caught either looking at or showing students inappropriate stuff on the computer that could have been of a sexual nature.
And then that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, but then some people think that the teacher then got confused, looked at what they were reading in class, and thought that was what was happening. Mm-hmm. So I think there may be some miscommunication, there may be some misunderstanding, or they may just be stupid.
In any case, the teacher has been placed on administrative leave, and the parent asked the police to file criminal charges. I don't think that's happened yet, though.
Okay.
Or that it will happen, actually.
And Orson Scott Card actually chimed in at one point. I don't have the exact quote up in front of me right now, but he was not amused, needless to say, which is pretty funny because he's kind of an outspoken guy. But he was not happy with this. He basically thought they were idiots.
Well, I get how out of context a child might explain something that happened in Ender's Game to one's parents who don't know anything about these books and the parent be concerned. But it sounds like a case of somebody going off low evidence and not trying to understand what was going on. Because, this sounds just like the same thing we've heard for decades around books like Huck Finn, right? Or Catcher in the Rye. Where they read them in middle school and the parent may have never heard of those books before and gets all bent out of shape because there's a sexual situation or an inappropriate situation. And we have this big debate about literature. The only thing that's different this time is the sci-fi book.
But it's
the same debate.
This is the quote from Orson Scott Card. He said, Ender's Game has been on an evangelical hit list for a long time for no other reason but that I'm Mormon, Card said. Card said he wrote the dialogue in 1984 based on what he was hearing children say to each other when they thought there were no adults around. So the book would not have shocked the South Carolina class. He said there is nothing pornographic in the book. There's nothing in Ender's Game that they are not completely familiar with, Card said. These kids are 14 years old in South Carolina. I know for a fact that it's impossible that they aren't hearing those words at least once a week, if not every day. Card said his book should have nothing to do with the suspension of the teacher. It was the inappropriate material from the internet that would have contributed to the suspension. The other things that the teacher was reading included things that were simply out of place, Card said. I'm not leaping to the defense of the teacher. He showed very poor judgment. Should he lose his job? Oh, come on. People should have room to learn.
Yeah. And you know what? The students in question are 14 years old. The one that the parent is complaining on behalf of is 14. Common Sense Media recommends Ender's Game for ages 12 and over.
If Common Sense Media recommends it, it's above reproach in my mind.
Well, what happened, I think what this really comes down to is that they did not run the book by the school. The teachers in this particular school have a policy that books have to be reviewed prior to use in class, and this teacher didn't do that, and so they got trouble.
Oh, all right. Well, whatever.
Well, you know, the school does have the right. The school, not the school board, but the principal and the faculty have the right to kind of say, yeah, it's a good idea to read those five books in your English class. Sounds good to me, right? I mean, it's not about at that point censorship. It's about what's a well balanced. Thing or the principal say, you know what, if you read Ender's Game, you need to make real sure that you're careful about this and that because it might set off some parents, and kind of arming that teacher to be prepared for this sort of thing. But the school got blindsided by it. Again, I'm not defending the parent saying Ender's Game is inappropriate for schools. It's totally appropriate for schools.
You are so defending them.
But what I am saying
is, just like you, Tom.
There's the reality. There's the real politic of being prepared for certain reactions from people.
It does seem like this is getting way blown out of proportion. But I will stand by my statement that it is silly to not allow 14-year-olds to read Ender's Game.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, say what you will about Card and his politics and his beliefs. I mean, we've discussed this ad nauseum in the forums.
I'm nauseous.
I'm feeling a little nauseous myself right now. Ender's Game is a great book, and I think it's totally within the young adult genre and comfort zone. And Common Sense Media is a site and an organization that I have followed for a very long time and stand by their rating system. And if they say that Ender's Game is safe for 12 and up, then I damn well believe them.
I'll say this. There is an inappropriate way to introduce anything in a classroom. Doesn't matter what it is. So the problem here seems to me an improper handling of material by the teacher, either in a curriculum way or in a not really understanding the parental audience way. But I don't think the problem is with Ender's Game.
All right, well, let's move on to a book review by Charlie Jane Anders over on io9 of 1Q84. Now, is Charlie a she? I get the feeling that Charlie is she, but I'm not sure. Yeah, I guess it's Jane, Charlie Jane Anders, and yes, she is a she. Not a huge fan of 1Q84, Charlie. She says that if she were to recommend it compared to other Murakami books out there, she probably would not do so and would say to probably start with Hard-Boiled Wonderland and The End of the World or maybe Wild Sheep Chase. So yeah, this is a great review. It really, I think, especially for people who may not be too familiar with Murakami or who finished 1Q84 and kind of had that what just happened to me feeling. It's a good review to kind of tie some of those feelings together and see that you are not alone. There's other people out there who are very well versed in science fiction and fantasy who have no idea what just hit them.
She says, I wouldn't necessarily recommend 1Q84 to neophytes, Murakami neophytes, but it's got enough rich imagery and neat ideas to be worth delving into, especially if you're hungry for a novel about ideas in which the power of storytelling is approached in a very different way than the one you typically see from Western authors. And the reason I wanted to talk about it on the show is I felt like a lot of our critics on the Goodreads forum were saying very similar things to what Charlie Jane Anders is saying, mm-hmm. but she does identify what it was that I liked about it. it was sort of like, yeah, okay, it's a little bit meandering. There's you know, there's a lot of weird imagery, repetition of plot points, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all fair criticisms, but those didn't bother me. I liked the poeticness of it. I liked the imagery. I liked the playing with ideas and Fukaeri. And just reading this review brought back a lot of the parts of the story that I really enjoyed.
That's funny you say that, because reading this review made me relive my frustration and not having a satisfying ending.
That makes perfect sense, actually.
And being like, oh, God, well, I'm so happy I finished that book. I'm glad I read it, but man, that was frustrating. I feel like I never got anywhere, and maybe that's a misstep on my part as a reader somehow. And now I'm feeling a little more less alone.
I think somebody like me who enjoyed it could very easily try to say, like, well, you're just not reading it right. But I don't think that's it. I think it's all a matter of whether that imagery and whether that atmosphere is appealing to you. And if it's not, you're just going to be frustrated by everything. Absolutely. It's a matter of, like, it's like looking at a painting and saying, oh, I like the colors, I like the imagery. And somebody else is like, yeah, it's not my thing. And that's fine. Mm-hmm.
Also on IO9, we have a post about science fiction and fantasy book series that started out as trilogies. This is fun because I've read a lot of these series, and it's funny to think that they had just started out as a trilogy and that was it, or perhaps, you know, sometimes even less than that. But some of the examples they give are Kushiel's Mercy, or the Kushiel Legacy series, which starts with Kushiel's Dart, and that was in 2001. And I love that series. I think we're going to touch on that in Vaginal Fantasy at some point. But great series. You know, A Song of Ice and Fire, also apparently meant to be a trilogy, which I did not know. Actually, maybe I did know that.
In 1991, he began writing the basis for a Game of Thrones with the idea of doing a Tolkien-esque trilogy. Mm-hmm.
And then it just went on beyond that.
Yeah. And then, of course, Dune by Frank Herbert was a trilogy that he revisited and launched a second trilogy, essentially. The God Emperor of Dune, Heretics of Dune, and Chapter House being the last three. And, of course, Frank's son, Brian Herbert, has expanded the universe into many, many sequels and prequels.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Ender's Game, also meant to be a trilogy. And I would agree that maybe it should have stayed as a trilogy. Because I would say that the further along the series goes, the more confusing, nonsensical, and kind of boring it gets.
I still like the first six, but then when it starts to when it starts to meander past that, even I let go. Yeah. Foundation Trilogy is another one that, again, started off as a very good, solid trilogy, and then Asimov turned his attention elsewhere. It came back to it in 1982, and expanded it beyond a trilogy. And I think the best example is actually Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, really just one book based on radio scripts. Then The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, Life, the Universe, and Everything, also pulled out of those radio scripts. And he thinks that's it, right? Mm-hmm. I've mined the radio scripts for all I can do. And then he goes on and writes So Long and Thanks for All the Fish and Mostly Harmless. And then even after he's dead, there was a book added to the increasingly inaccurately named Hitchhiker's Trilogy. And now, I can't remember what the name of the author was.
So tell me about this post on the Word Zone that you added.
Oh, now I'm obsessed with finding the other non-Douglas.
Well, I need your help because I didn't add this post and I don't know what it's about.
I know. Just give me a second.
So you have to tell me. You have to tell me, though.
Okay, fine. James S.A. Corey's Facebook fan page, run by Ty Frank and Daniel Abraham, has announced that the third book in the Expanse space opera series will be called Abaddon's Gate. This is an update. They were originally going to call it Dandelion Sky, but they thought that sounded, quote, too pastoral and Ray Bradbury for the book as it is. So I am not a big fan of this series, but if you are, figured you might be interested to know that third book is on its way and it's got a new title.
I'm not loving the redesign on the Word Zone.
Oh, really?
Yeah, not loving it. Sorry, Adam. It's just very vanilla. I mean,
I like it. It's very
good.
Simple.
It's nice
it's out of the
simple,
way.
But also, we got to get to the wordzone.com somehow.
Ian Colfer
this
and another
blogspot.com thing. Not working for me.
Got it. Ian Colfer.
Ian Colfer.
And another thing.
And another thing.
And another thing.
What are you talking about?
That's the other book in the Hitchhiker's trilogy.
Oh, okay.
That was not written by Douglas Adams.
Okay, let's move on to the calendar. These are the upcoming book releases. Where do you want to read down to?
April 3rd.
Okay.
It's a, like it says.
Oh, it does? Oh, I didn't see that. See, I looked at the rundown, then you added things afterwards, and I get confused because I memorize everything.
Do not.
Yes, I do. On March 27th, we have Fair Coin by E.C. Myers. 16-year-old Ephraim Scott is horrified when he comes home from school and finds his mother unconscious at the kitchen table, clutching a bottle of pills. The reason for her suicide attempt is even more disturbing. She thought she had identified Ephraim's body at the hospital that very day. Among his dead body double's belongings, Ephraim finds a strange coin, a coin that grants wishes when he flips it, and apparently did not keep his body double alive.
No, it didn't grant that. Body Inc. by Alan Dean Foster, also coming out today, maybe, if you're listening to this on March 27th. In a world deeply wounded by centuries of environmental damage, two unlikely souls join forces. You wouldn't have thought it. Dr. Ingrid Seastrom has stumbled into a mystery involving quantum entangled nanoscale implants. And you know what? This mystery might just kill her. So you're going to have to read the book to find out if she's safe.
March 31st, we have Indomitable by Terry Brooks and Mauricio Manzieri. Master fantasist Terry Brooks first conjured the unforgettable world of the magic-racked Four Lands more than three decades ago, and its boundaries continue to expand into new territory. With Indomitable, Brooks provides an essential epilogue to the beloved Shannara trilogy that started it all.
Then looking ahead to April 3rd, Scott Sigler, who will be our first guest on the inaugural YouTube Sword and Laser show, is going to be proudly releasing Nocturnal, something living beneath the streets of San Francisco. It's been there for centuries, but only comes out at night to feed on the dregs of society, a subculture with its own myths, its own legends of the leader named the King that will lead them out of bondage. And they get their own demon, a hunting shadow known only as the Savior.
We also have The Road of Danger, Lieutenant Leary by David Drake. We talked about that a little bit in the last episode. And also Banner of the Damned by Sherwood Smith. And, we're only going to April 3rd, huh? Because I feel like we went down to all these before on last week's episode.
We did. You're right. Because there's really nothing else coming out to talk about till April 24th when we get Stephen King's Wind Through the Keyhole, which is the next book in the old Roland Deschain Book of the Eld.
Interesting. All right. Well, then we'll save that for another time. We will save that for another time. But right now we will move on to Barrier Sword, which is our feedback from the audience. Now, this was hilarious. It's a post on Boing Boing that was linked to from the Goodreads forums by Alden O'Neill. And this is some thieving types. Boing Boing's list of vagabonds and what they mean specifically. It's a list of 23 types of vagabonds as identified in a 1566 book by Thomas Harman called A Caveat or Warning for Common Cursitors, vulgarly called vagabonds.
If you don't want to be called vulgar, you want to refer to rogues or wild rogues for those born of rogues. Or if you're talking about a horse thief, priggers of prancers.
Or apparently Abrams, which are feigned lunatics, or drummerers, which are sham deaf mutes.
I like that there are two kinds of harlots. There's the married harlots, which you call autumn morts, or the unmarried harlots, which you call walking morts.
Interesting.
And then doxies. That one's still around. Doxy.
They
a prostitute who begin with upright men. Yeah, exactly.
So they're fancier?
They're propped up. I don't know.
Demanders for glimmer or fire.
And dude, you're getting Adele meant something totally different back then.
What does loss of fire mean? Female beggars pretending loss of fire?
Oh, I haven't. I think, I'm just totally guessing here, but it may have been when you kept like a coal around and carried it around and would rent it out to start fires.
That sounds painful.
But matches
you
were expensive.
That in your pocket?
Well, no, you carried it in like a little metal thing with tongs and stuff.
Well, people were mentioning this because obviously The Lies of Locke Lamora deals with various types of, not vagabonds, maybe towards the end, but more, they're thieves. They're thieving their way through
life.
They're
drunken tinkers is what they are.
Are they?
Thieves using the trade as a cover.
Yes, drunken. No, but tinkers is a specific type of shopkeeper.
They didn't always go as tinkers. That was pretty rare.
Tinkers. You will find lots of discussion of tinkers in the Kingkiller Chronicles, I believe.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's true.
All right. And then also there was a post started by Otto about road tripping. He says, time for a road trip. So next week I pack up the family truckster and head to Seattle to my in-laws in Montana. 24 hours on the road with my wife and kids. And then he makes an O face like, oh. One thing that makes the trip go much faster is a good audiobook to keep us engaged through the I-90 corridor. My kids range in age from 11 to 17. In the past, we've listened to Harry Potter, The Hunger Games, The Hobbit, The Book of Three / The Black Cauldron, and it made the time go much quicker. Now I have to figure out what's next. Here's the trick. It's got to be engaging. You know, great plot, great reading. Has to be appropriate for kids. No sex or bad language, etc.
Unsensemedia.org.
And it has to be something I haven't read to keep me engaged, too. Ready? Go! Hey. So we have a lot of great suggestions on here. Actually, Irene posted several. Among the Hidden, Uglies, Pretties, Specials, which is a trilogy. The Transol Saga, if your kids like Hatchet or any of the Brian books, is a similar but on a red planet. Divergent, The Red Pyramid, The Emerald Atlas, and classic trilogy, the Tripod Trilogy by John Christopher, which includes The White Mountains, The City of Gold and Lead, and The Pool of Fire.
And Jess and Random both recommend The We Free Men.
Mm-hmm. That is Terry Pratchett, which I also very much enjoyed. I would recommend that as well. And the Tiffany Aching series, which is related to The We... it is The We Free Men. I thought they were different. No, I think... Oh, that's the first book in the Tiffany Aching series. So that's why it makes sense. Discworld.
Otto said, thanks for all the recommendations. The drive is roughly 24 hours round trip, so longer stories will work. And he said, it doesn't have to be youth-based. He said, Hitchhiker's Guide is a great example.
Very cool. And then we also have a post about, in our TVs and movies and video games section, about a new film series that is coming shortly called 50 Shades of Grey. And apparently this is going into a big bidding war and is actually going to be made into a film. But it started out as kind of fan fiction. It's like Twilight fan fiction that progressed to the next level and became a separate book series. But the two main characters are essentially Edward and Bella.
Yeah, it's an interesting rights issue about, you know, how you're able to take characters and ideas from one universe and port them over into a sort of an alternate universe. And yet Hollywood's all over it. They're like, yeah, we can definitely do this. The novel, for those unaware, got its start as sort of naughty BSDM / fic, at least according to the Huffington Post. But it's been cleaned up. At least the idea is to clean it up for this sort of situation. We talked about this on Frame Rate, Brian Brushwood and I, interesting it is that fanfic would turn into something that is almost unidentifiable to the original in such a way that even Hollywood studios would be willing to bid on it and take a risk on it without having to have the rights to the original material.
Well, if it's not really the original material, though, I mean, it's fan fiction.
Yeah, but you know, if I say, I'll be interested how much
and
or
if change the names
characters
and change
are actually
the story,
called, if they're actually called Bella and Edward, then they couldn't do it. But if they change it enough, then you're right. It doesn't really matter what they're called as long as it's an original idea, as long as it's not lifted directly from the other books.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not. It's not lifted at all. I mean, it's a totally separate story at this point, but it's
and they're
started...
not called Bella and Edward. See, I thought you were saying they were.
No, they're based on them. They're essentially just, Bella and Edward.
But they're not called that, so you can get away with it.
There you go. So it should be fun. And it should have a built-in fan base, so that's kind of funny, too. And I think it's the first time I've ever heard of anyone taking, you know, slash fic and turning it into an actual work of...
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine if a lot of the Star Trek fanfic had been turned into actual television? Harder to do that and change the names, I guess.
Yeah, I don't want to think about that. That's creepy.
But you know what there is, and I'm not talking about necessarily the sexual fanfic, but there's been a lot of fanfic stories that have been turned into videos in lots of different places of Star Trek with the approval of the studios, basically saying, look, as long as you don't charge money for it, we'll let you use the franchise's trappings and call it Star Trek, which is pretty cool.
Interesting. All right, well, let's move on. Actually, we have a great interview coming up with author Scott Lynch. He is, of course, the author of the book we just finished reading, The Lies of Lachlan Mara, Gentleman Bastard number one. So let's get right into it. Just a quick heads up to anyone listening with kids out there. Scott swears like a gentleman bastard, so if that's something that bothers you, you may want to skip ahead to the end. Scott, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Howdy. Thank you for having me.
So this is your first novel, is that correct? The Lies of Lachlan Mara?
Yes, it was.
Did you do a lot of other writing before that?
I would not say a hell of a lot. I did a whole bunch of role-playing stuff that I self-published a couple years previous. So I'd written a fairly large page count, but at that point, in terms of coherent actual fiction, I'd written one short story that had won a contest back in 2001 at a local convention. And that was really about it. There was not a hell of a lot prior to Lies.
We do hear a lot of authors say that they've done a lot of writing for RPGs, role-playing, etc. Do you carry much of that universe over into the Gentleman Bastards?
Not really. I still carry the gamer mentality, obviously. I don't think in negative terms of all my years, rolling dice. I had a great deal of fun with it. And I still would be if not for, stupid life intruding on all that. I did work in the D20 system back when Dungeons & Dragons 3rd Edition had just been released, and most of what I did was superhero flavored, so it was not what you would call directly relevant to Lies of Lachlan Mara. So it was not developed as a game setting in advance. There was really nothing that was a trial run for my eventual fiction.
That's not a hint that superheroes will show up in book six.
No. Captain America's not going to, knock a brick wall down, and Batman's not going to show up, because then I'd be sued into oblivion. So not even cheap knockoff Batman's or Captain America's. No.
Or Captain United States.
Captain Placeholder.
Yeah. Nope. United States guy.
There. Captain Ersatz, also known as Captain not appearing in this novel, no.
Captain non-specific country.
That's funny that you mentioned that, because we actually have a somewhat related question from one of our listeners. He says, just how familiar is Scott Lynch with the Complete Thief's Handbook from the second edition of the AD&D game? Because there's some stuff in there about designing thieves' guilds that tastes a lot like The Lies of Lachlan Mara, and I was wondering if it was a source of inspiration at all.
A literary background question. How do I feel about the works of Poe? How do I feel about War and Peace? How do I feel about the Thieves' Complete Handbook, second edition? I have a growing nostalgia collection of first edition stuff, and I have a fairly decent selection of second edition stuff. Other than a nostalgic attachment to it, I actually largely hated Dungeons and Dragons until third edition came out, because I consider previous editions to be pretty kludgy and badly designed and nigh unplayable, and I did not have good playing experiences. I didn't play Dungeons & Dragons with my high school gaming buddies. I played a lot of Vampire the Masquerade and Star Wars, and a little bit of Earth Dawn. And I have a deep appreciation for these games in like I said, a very nostalgic fashion. I used to go to the public library, which was apparently it had one sort of esoteric, ultra secret, crazy person, because back in the day they used to have some of the weirdest books there, including the original Deities and Demigods and the original Monster Manual. Mm-hmm. And I would read these things when I was 10 or 11, having no idea what this game was or what these statistics meant, just knowing that it was incredibly cool that here were these books that were chock full of monsters, and listings that would tell you how many thunderbolts Zeus could throw, in a given span of time, and how many times this spider could bite your face off. I have a deep, deep, deep appreciation for it that does not actually extend to having played the game much. And coming back to the actual specifics of the question, which I've now danced away from for about 6 hours, no, I never read that particular handbook and have no idea what's in it.
It's convergent evolution, sounds like.
You know, I mean, I was vaguely aware of all these assorted class books and kit books and so on and so forth. But it was nothing that my gaming buddies were ever using or running at the time. So there was never really any reason to pull it off the shelf.
Well, continuing with the world building questions, Nick on our forum asks, which was created first, the character of Loch Lamora or the world of Kamor?
Okay, well, this is an incredibly nerdy answer for you.
That's the best kind.
But it is very appropriate. Loch was actually created first. Loch was created for a role-playing game. Loch was created for a very brief Star Wars role-playing game back when Wizards of the Coast did their D20 version of Star Wars.
Oh, wow.
After West End Games lost the license. And I only got to play it for a session or two. But it was a very fun, very childish sort of, you know, making radio noises by covering our mouths with our hands and uh-huh. Rogues and tramp freighters, et cetera, et cetera. Loch was a force sensitive from a planet that had sort of eluded galactic attention for, you know, centuries. Through the efforts of this tiny little core of, oh God, what the hell did they call them? They called them provocateurs, royal provocateurs. They were force adepts or force sensitives or whatever the not Jedi. You know, the Diet Pepsi Jedi class, lightsaber wielders. And the whole shtick was that this planet had no military. It had no great wealth. It just kept out of the way of galactic events through the efforts of this tiny little crew of, you know, sort of stainless steel rat meets diplomat extraordinary meets troubleshooter meets spy meets, you know, half-assed force-sensitive characters who would basically go out and kind of tip the scales and work confidence games and make secret negotiations. And that's how this planet, you know, would avoid getting flattened by the vast events going on around them. So Loch, who had no last name, was one of these people who, you know, promptly went out in the grand fashion of, hey, it's a Dungeons & Dragons type game. I want to play a really thoughtful, clever character, and just got his ass smeared. By killer droids and whatnot. You know, he's the guy who sits in the back of the party holding the band-aids, you know, while everybody else who made better feat choices saves the day. But when it was over, I actually found myself returning to that character, thinking that, you know, hey, there may be some more mileage to be had out of this guy. And I'm really sorry. I can't give people short answers. Apparently, I just don't shut up.
It wouldn't be an interview if they were short answers. It would be like a multiple choice quiz or something. So no, we appreciate the long answers.
But yes, that's where Loch came from. He actually does predate Kamor and everything else in his world by quite a bit.
He has an almost Han Solo-ish vibe to me in a way. Like the second you said Star Wars, I'm like, he kind of feels like Han Solo to me, but maybe I'm totally off base with that.
There are worse things to emulate than, you know, Harrison Ford being super sexy, awesome, ass-kicking, you know, raking in hundreds of millions of dollars for it. So, you know, I'm not going to argue with that interpretation.
You know, that's funny that you mentioned Harrison Ford, because we had a discussion thread going on in the forums about who we would cast in the roles of all these characters in your book. And we actually found one of your live journal posts where you kind of discussed this. But you didn't say who you would cast as Loch. You left that out.
The can of worms. You cast as Loch. Okay, this is a game that I have played a couple of times with my editors, and I hear all sorts of names from time to time. And one of the names that I constantly hear is, "Oh, my grandmother thinks Johnny Depp would be an awesome Loch."
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Depp's plastic. He could do almost any character you could. He could do all your characters, essentially.
He's nearly 50, you know, and you know, holding that against him. He's a very well preserved nearly 50, but you know, Loch as we see him at at the beginning of the series is in his mid-20s. And, you know, the actors they toss around, like Robert Downey Jr., Johnny Depp, you know, both of whom are very deserving, capable, entertaining actors, are, you know, guys in their late 40s. And that's just not going to suit, you know, if a miracle occurred and, you know, this stuff was ever adapted. One actor that I did cite when I was playing this game with my editor was, listen to me brain fart. Why am I such an idiot?
What was it? Maybe we can help.
High Fidelity, John Cusack.
Yeah, I can see that too.
Circa 1990, in the early 90s, when he was in his early 20s, because he has that combination of nervous intelligence and cheekiness and slyness, I think, that would really suit the character.
I can kind of see Andrew Garfield, the guy who's playing the next Spider-Man, as being a... He's young enough, and he kind of has some of those personality traits that I think might be fun. But I don't know if he's quite slick enough.
I have not seen him myself personally. I've not paid too much attention to the current Spider-Man reboot. I've reached an age where I am now a cantankerous old geek because you know, I've seen all of this shit rebooted 8 million times before. So I might see it when it comes out, but I'm not exactly hanging on to the project with bated breath.
I posted you his Wikipedia page in the Skype chat if you're interested in taking a look. I'm making casting decisions for you now.
Sure.
But we can move on to the next question. It comes from Terp Kristen, and she wants to know, I'd ask him what he thinks Locke's motivations are, since it was such a hot topic over here on the forums. Is he motivated purely to be the best trickster out there, to be a Robin Hood of sorts, you know, without the giving to the poor part, or does he have a deeper goal?
Okay, complex question, because I did not consciously set up. I mean, you're not going to, if you opened his brains up and if you could look into, you know, the dysfunctional water wheels turning therein. I'm looking at Andrew Garfield's IMDb listing, by the way. He looks a little bit he looks a little bit Malcolm in the Middle for what I think of as Locke. But I guess if you gave him a year or two, I guess I could kind of see it.
There's a distinct lack of cynical glibness in the generation that is the right age for this role.
Yeah, you really you need to just transplant like a 38-year-old actor's brain into a 24-year-old actor's body, and if someone could just that, I'm sure it would be very convenient for me.
We have scientists in our audience. They'll get to work on that.
Get out there and do science, people. What is Locke's motivation? He's not a character that I really designed to have. You know, there is no one overriding goal. You know, there is nothing floating around in his head with an exclamation point. No, I will be the greatest thief ever. I mean, he is intended to be as realistic a psychological portrait of an occasionally heroic and wildly effective human being as I can be. But he has, you know, severe weaknesses. You know, he's full of self-doubts. He's incredibly self-pitying. He has a borderline addictive personality. He falls into, you know, a culturally contextualized version of you know, alcoholism. He's reliant on the bottle at a couple of times in his life. He's driven by burning passions, but they don't burn all the time. So his motivation is a combination of everything that you're shown in the book. You know, his pathological loyalty to his friends, his somewhat confused mandate from his dead mentor to lead the gang and you know, keep them safe. And the other thing about him is that he is designed to unfold over the course of, you know, 7 books rather than 1. And that's a conscious decision. And God, is that a cop-out on my
But that was actually the explanation I was giving when we did our most recent episode last time, is that I feel like you really get Locke's real motivation at the end of Lies of Locke Lamora. I mean, that's when he suddenly is fired up.
Yeah,
because of the Grey King.
I didn't want to, you know, I didn't just want to say, here is what Locke does because of reasons on page 10. Because I even when I was first starting to write this book in this series, I thought that was a boring approach. Now, mind you, I am absolutely allergic to, and I am always absolutely aghast to hear people say things like, well, you know, don't mind the first 500 pages. You know, it actually gets good somewhere in, you know, book 4.
Of course, no author wants to hear that.
Yeah. That is an absolute cop-out. That is bullshit. And the structure that I've set up is not going to be everybody's cup of tea. I mean, I frankly admit that. You know, it's going to appeal to some people who like a mystery and who enjoy a slow unfolding of a character's psychology and motivations. And, you know, to others who would rather find out a little bit more, a little bit quicker, yeah, it's going to seem... It's probably going to seem deficient. I'll just be harsh and say that. You know, it's an aesthetic choice. But you will discover if you stick with these books, you will discover that the odd numbered books are heavily nested with flashbacks to Locke's youth and his upbringing and so on and so forth. You know, you can look at the two that are commercially available right now. Lies is, you know, half past, half present. Red Seas Under Red Skies has a flashback or two, but then it is one long present, you know, adult Locke and John plot thread. Republic of Thieves goes back to half and half past and present, and then book 4 is entirely in the present. Book 5 basically wraps up the past storyline and, you know, flings Locke into the events of the last two books. So it's essentially who he is and where he came from is spread out over books 1, 3, and 5 in the sequence. And you get a good hint of what's going on in Lies. And, you know, it's the story of an undeniably clever man who is sitting on an inheritance, for lack of a better word. I mean, the gentleman bastards are sitting on a pile of money, and you know, they were sitting on a pile of money. As the book opens, they don't want for anything, but if it was simply a case of wanting, if it was simply a case of, you know, hey, we need money so we can you know, spend it on cool stuff, there'd be no story. They would just take their money and run. Part of the story is that Locke and his friends screw this situation up horrendously. They don't entirely know what to do with this, except sit on it and attempt to grow it. And their lackadaisical attitude toward the inheritance they've been given backfires on them tremendously. And they're going to have numerous occasions in the future of their lives, as you see starting in Red Seas, to repent their having taken what they received from Chains for granted. So Locke is driven by guilt. Locke is driven by duty. Locke is undeniably driven by greed, since I think I've shown him to be not quite an uncontrolled kleptomaniac, but he is definitely, he gets a little drunk on the act of stealing. It's his thrill. It's his compulsion, not to the point of ridiculousness, but certainly to the point of being one of his fundamental motivations. And I'm so sorry. Are you guys still awake?
Yes.
Yeah. No. Actually, I was okay. Just thinking, not to spoil anything for you, Veronica, but in Red Seas, early on, that idea of being drunk on thievery really really is well displayed as he sobers up.
Well, it seems almost like if he sees an opportunity, he's not going to pass on it. In almost everything, like even if it's not at all worth his while for several different reasons, he'll just go for it because he feels compelled to.
Yeah, the thing about Locke is that you know, all the stories about the Thorn of Kamor that have been spread around, and you know what I'm saying here is full of spoilers. So I'm really hoping that people
this is the wrap up episodes.
We are assuming people have read Lies, but not necessarily that they've read Red Seas.
Okay, so you know, everybody's read the bits with the aliens and the talking sharks at this point, and you know, the camp.
That That's where the Elder Glass came from.
Locke goes back to the mothership, and okay, we're all on the same page.
Yes.
There is a little bit in Red Seas Under Red Skies where I sort of spilled the beans about what the philosophical and religious motivations are for what Locke does and for why did Chains do this thing? Where he set this little group of tight-knit thieves up essentially to philosophically thumb their noses at everything that Kappa Barsavi stood for and demanded of them. Mm-hmm. There are good reasons for it. And they are explored. They just are not explored in the first book. And that's just the way it is. You may have noticed that I left certain parts of the story out. You may have noticed the absence of a certain redheaded love interest, who is only loosely alluded to in the first novel, much to the consternation of thousands and thousands. Really.
It might have come up. Yeah.
Yeah. You might have heard something about that. Why don't you throw another question at me so I don't keep talking for 9 minutes?
No, that's okay. We really are hanging on your words here, as much as that may be hard for you to believe, because you're giving us a lot of good information that we can't get from anywhere else. We're absolutely enjoying exploring this, because that's what we do on the show, is we read this stuff and then we banty about what we think is going to happen and what we think should happen.
The thing I should say is that... so much of the stuff about the Thorn of Kamor, the myth, the legend, it's all just bullshit. It was obviously all just made up. Locke is not a Robin Hood figure, but the character that is based on him is sort of a Robin Hood figure in the popular imagination. Though if you went out into Kamor and asked anybody, when's the last time the Thorn of Kamor gave you any money, nobody would be able to tell you that it had happened. Locke is... not interested in small-time grift. Locke is the sort of conscientious thief who will set his sights on real fat cats, on the real haves, on merchants and the nobility. And he's not the sort of guy who would steal crusts of bread from the mouths of people who don't have anything else, except when he loses sight of his morality, which he does in The Lies of Locke Lamora. There's a scene where he does something really, really awful to a waiter at Miraggio's counting house. Using this man who undeniably has a moment of greedy weakness, and Locke essentially ruins his life. Locke uses him as a cat's paw in a very complex little improvised grift to get inside this place. And when it's over, this guy cannot go back to work. He will, his throat will be slit. He'll be found, in a canal. Locke gives him some money and says, "You got to go, buddy."
Tries to make up for it, but.
Yeah, congratulations. You get to leave the only place you've probably ever known and the only set of skills you probably have, and you get to go upriver and do something else now. Work on a dirt farm or go to some other city and enjoy your miserable existence. Have a nice life. It's reprehensible. It's morally indefensible because Locke has absolutely lost sight at that point of his usual mandates and his usual feelings. He has a moment of weakness and desperation. He has those. That's the kind of thief he is. He when he's in control of himself, he doesn't steal for stealing's sake. But sometimes he forgets that actions have consequences.
Now, I got to throw this question at you that gets thrown at a lot of the authors we read. Patrick Rothfuss comes to mind as one. Rasputin says, "I'd like to know why he chose to use real-world profanity instead of making up profanity. Is it for the impact, for the humor, just because he effing felt like it?" And it's one of those things where our audience is split. A lot of people loved that, and others felt it took them away from the fantasy world.
It was a combination of everything. I mean, it was an aesthetic choice. It was for impact, undeniably. Even though I feel differently about the use of naughty cuss words than many people. I mean, I explained recently on my live journal. I don't think that loose swearing, to coin a phrase, since I can't really think of any other way to describe it. I don't see it as having an ethical or moral dimension. I don't see it as being a bad thing. It's part of the tapestry of our language. You know, it's there to be used and it's there to be harnessed. And there's undeniably a time and a place for it. You know, I don't tend to talk like that. You know, when I'm introducing myself to strangers, I will swear up a storm in intimate company. You know, at the fire department. Et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's a time and a place. As for the use of it in my fiction, it's part of what I'm trying to strike out against. Part of what fantasists of my stripe strike out against is this notion of the pure and untrammeled Disneyland version of these fictional universes and these fantasy pasts. You know, we are not interested, and you know, this is really arrogant of me speaking as though we're some sort of conglomerate block. You know, we don't do this. That, since I, you know, specifically do not identify with movements, manifestos, and that sort of bullshit. I'll speak for myself. I'm very, very interested in in-depth and realistic and internally consistent portrayals of fantasy universes, but I'm not interested in portrayals that pretend that, you know, that people don't piss and people don't shit and people don't swear and people don't have to evolve mechanisms for dealing with these things. You know, these are there's a point where you dwell too much on the gritty and the grimy and the gross. But I think to a certain extent, you know, it marks the style of fantasy in which I write. You know, there's never really any mention in Tolkien of who empties the chamber pots. You know, it never comes up, and that's fine. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be part of the tapestry. There's a word I use far too often of you know, any given work. But
or who cleans the tapestries
for the flavor and the goals of the sort of thing that I write. I think it is absolutely essential to confront human frailties, human habits, realistic psychological human portraits, and genuine accoutrements of human society. And people are vulgar. You know, people have bad manners, and you know, you can spot the patterns. You know, the nobility will not tend to swear in public, but they'll swear in private. The criminals will tend to swear whenever they feel like it. People tend to swear whenever they get their dander up. You know, it's a difficult little dance to do. And I can, how can I put this? Since I publicly said that I don't feel any real sympathy for people who have a problem with this, because as I've said, you know, there are some real horrors and real cruelties illuminated in this book. And there are real horrors and cruelties going on in the world around us right now, of which bad language, as far as I'm concerned, is so far down the list of things that can and should be dealt with. You know, it just makes me laugh cynically.
Well, and if you want to depict someone as cursing, it's hard to have that have the impact if you don't actually have them cursing. If you have them, you know, saying a made-up fairyland word, it just it doesn't hit you as hard.
Fictional made-up word is, I mean, you know, sometimes they can be elegantly done. My general experience in science fiction and fantasy is that made-up swearing, I mean, you know, all you have to do is read the words of, you know, read Heinlein's, you know, made-up made-up swear words. You know, tange, it's short for there ain't no justice. Who the hell is going to run around yelling tange every time, you know, hit their thumb with a hammer?
I'm going to start using that now.
Tange, you know, Battlestar Galactica, you know, uses frack, you know, which is pretty close, and you know, it's the gosh darn equivalent of fuck, which is, you know, close enough to the cold hard proper Anglo-Saxon you know, word that you can kind of get away with it. You know, the spirit is there. It's very, 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 very difficult to come up with ersatz swearing that sounds like anything that would ever come out of anyone's mouth in a moment of stress. And I just didn't see any percentage in attempting to invent cutesy aphorisms or some form of swearing, or, you know, God help us, some sort of, you know, really purple over the top, you know, by the seven eyeballs of Zorflab.
I'm going to start using that one now.
I kind of like that one, but yeah, for a totally different reason.
That out at your next, you know, job interview or something.
So our the next question comes from Napo. He wants to know, I'm dying to know more about these society/creatures that lived before humans in Kamor. Where are they? What happened to them? Can it happen again? And like someone else asked, Marcus, a short introduction to the magic system would be welcomed. I feel it's too overpowered. It has to have some kind of backlash for the user, or why don't the Bonds Mages rule the world with Bonds Magi? Or do they, and it's just not presented in the first book?
Yeah. Like they'd tell you if they actually did, you know, like I'm saying, hey, we rule the world, dickheads. Well, that's one of those things that is actually, I'm going to once again plead, you know, if you just stick with the series for the first 4,800 pages, you'll find that all your questions are answered on page 4801. The third book, The Republic of Thieves, delves, well, I don't want to say too deeply, but relative to what you've seen before, it gives a lot more background and a lot more depth on the society and the intentions and the philosophy of the Bonds Magi, or the Magi of Carthane, depending upon what they're calling themselves this week. And, you know, there's also some discourse on, you know, where that name came from. And overpowered, you know, all magic is overpowered. I mean, if you've ever read Catherine Kurtz's Dureni series, I recently read it. It was thrown at me by a friend of mine 14 or 15 years ago, because he really liked its magic system. And I absorbed his thoughts on that magic system, even though I never read the books until last year. And the books are interesting, very much artifacts of their time. They are sort of proto-humanistic science fiction in that they're driven entirely by human politics and human arguments rather than by quests handed down from the sky. They are also, you know, corny and terrible in a lot of ways. The really interesting notions, especially expressed in the first Dureni book, is that very, very small acts of magic are incredibly powerful when considered in light of a society where nobody else has these powers. You know, what if all you could do with your magic is, you know, make a light or a little darkness or steal someone's memories for 2 minutes? You know, even if you have just this tiny little toolkit, it's something that nobody else does. It's something that can be applied to make you an extremely dangerous person. The Bonds Magi have something a little bit more than that. They have something more or less on par with your standard issue Conan/, you know, Fawford and the Grey Mouse for antagonists, sort of sword and sorcery. But they can't individually, you know, nuke cities. You know, there's a historical interlude described at the end of Lies of Locke Lamora, where we just what happens when 400 of them act together. In which case, yeah, horrible things happen. But individually, they can't do anything like that. It seems to me that it's a very natural and self-limiting form of overpowered behavior. In that, you know, what if you were the only adult in a room with 1,000 children? Are you individually more powerful than, you know, anybody in that room? Yes. Are you more powerful than 20 of them? Yes. What happens if all 1,000 of them gang up on you? You know, you'll be clubbed to death by Ewoks. Crude metaphor, but you know, they're. The Bonds Magi are ultimately only human. You know, they sleep, they bleed. Locke and John prove that very amply. You know, they have a great deal of arrogance and hubris. You know, it's entirely the Falconer is an entirely self-defeating antagonist. If he were not the arrogant son of a bitch that he is, Locke and John never would have been able to do to him what they did. Mm-hmm. other limiting factor on them is the fact that there's only a couple hundred of them in existence at any given time. It's a very rare thing. And this is all discussed in great detail, relatively speaking, in Republic of Thieves. And I don't want to give too much of that away.
I was going to say, what does it say about me that that is the second reference to children clubbing adults to death that I've had the past 2 days in my book clubs?
It's such a useful metaphor.
Yeah,
It's a trope.
It's a trope now.
All just closet Ewok fans is what it is. We just want to see the tall guys
beat up the stormtroopers in their Endor outfits. No. So Republic of Thieves, do we know when it's coming out?
We do not know when it's coming out. I hope to have that answer very, very shortly.
Cool.
The thing is that it's got to be slotted into the company's existing slots for books not written by crazy depressives who fuck their schedule up for a couple of they're obviously very eager to get it out, but they've got to slide it around with all the other campaigns they've got underway and all the other production time and marketing time that has already been allotted. This is a very delicate dance to intrude upon. So there are other concerns, above and beyond, oh, thank God he finished the book. That's not the issue. So I hope that we will know very shortly. And believe me, everybody will know as soon as I know, because I will tweet it and I will be insufferable about it. Social.
Excellent. We'll keep an eye out. Can you tell us more about the graphic novel?
The graphic novel?
Or I'm mistaken, but I saw an image on your website, and some people in the forums were passing around artistic renderings of Loch Lamara, and it looked like, is it just drawings that people have done about the book series, or is it something that's turning into a graphic novel at some point?
Oh, wow, that's a real game of telephone that developed there. What happened is I had a very firm policy of never ever officially condoning any fan art, simply because I did not want to codify what Locke and John actually looked like.
Mm-hmm.
I want there to be a certain element of everybody making up their minds for themselves and seeing what they want to see in their mind's eye. And this grand notion did not survive initial contact with Anna Maria Jung's cartoon version of Locke and John. And this is so weird. I was looking for a JPEG of the Japanese version of The Lives of Locke and Lamora, which has this gorgeous anime style painting of Locke and John. On a gondola in a beautiful Kenmore cityscape, and I think it's one of the better and more intriguing versions of the book's cover. And the Japanese version of Lies is one of the only foreign language editions that I did not receive. So I was out and about, and I Googled Loch Lamora Japan, and for whatever twisted Google foo was involved, it took me to the website of this Austrian cartoonist named Anna Maria Jung, who had done this incredibly cute Locke and John on the prowl in a fantasy city. And I just, my heart sort of melted over it. So I contacted her to ask if I could, I licensed it from her for a fee and used it for my Christmas cards last year and have an arrangement to use it to decorate my website in various ways for the next year.
Oh, very cool. Well, now I want it to be a graphic novel.
it is adorable, and she's working on longer projects, but nothing Gentleman Bastard related as far as I know. And then the image of Locke with the cats was just a little bonus that she sort of threw in after reading Red Seas. But that is where that came from. I wish I could say that I had the foresight to commission it, but it was a stray piece of art that I found and loved and could not leave alone. So I had to license it.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Can you tell our listeners where they can follow your work online?
You can always find an assortment of stuff at www.scottlynch.us, not .com or .net. It's .us, as in the country. You can also follow me on Twitter as at @scottlynch78. And I joined Goodreads recently. And you can spot me there from time to time as well. I'm slowly cataloging my... I'm getting ready to move here. And some means to actually count and catalog my books is sort of a godsend. So you will hopefully be able to see every book in my house. How's that?
That's awesome.
Excellent. You know what? Actually, we noticed that you posted up on Goodreads. Obviously, that's how we got in touch with you. And we have a poll up for our May book, which will be a science fiction book. Do you want to cast your vote now or wait and do it at the privacy of your own Goodreads browsing?
What are the options?
These are the options. Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin, Old Man's War by John Scalzi, City in the Stars by Arthur C. Clarke, The Player of Games by Ian M. Banks, and Hyperion by Dan Simmons.
Ooh, okay. Banks is magnificent. I personally think Scalzi's a great guy and a very funny writer. I don't think there's an awful lot of texture to Old Man's War. It's a very straightforward, fun little read, but it's a little bit it's a sort of cracker of a work. And I mean that in the best possible way. That sounds really arrogant and dickish. John writes great stuff. I just don't consider that to be one of his chewier works. Left Hand of Darkness is absolutely mind-bending and contains many passages that will haunt you. Although I expect that, you know, a certain portion of your readership is just going to lem it very quickly.
Oh, yes, you use lem.
And Hyperion is, I mean, you're going to get the same effect. A whole bunch of people are going to lem the hell of it. But Hyperion is also just an incredibly intricate, harrowing, amusing it's a very multifaceted jewel of a book that is very, very worth pursuing, even if the sequels aren't so hot. That's kind of the curse of Dan Simmons as a writer is that very few people write better openings to books. He gives you superior first 75% and then totally fails to stick the landing. So if you just read to the end of Hyperion and then don't read any further, you probably won't be any more disappointed than you can be. But that first book is just absolutely amazing. So I would vote for either Hyperion or The Left Hand of Darkness. They are both justifiably described as classics.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you will continue to join in on the discussions over on Goodreads. It's been a blast having you on the show, and you don't hold anything back. I love that. And you use the newly crafted verb lem, which I will be a fan for life for that.
So much fun to say, lem.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks so much for Scott Lynch for joining us, and I'm excited to read the next book, actually. I'll probably pick that up at some point.
I'm actually reading it right now.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Fantastic. There are some parts that I still want to catch up on in terms of other characters we never really got to learn more about, like his girlfriend that they talked about so much in their childhood, but never
actually
got to
meet. I'm not going to say anything because it'd be a spoiler.
Of course it would be. Okay, let's go on to the emails. We have one from Tyler. He writes in, "Hey there, I'm an assistant librarian at Parman Library here in San Antonio, Texas. I was wondering, since you guys have quite the following, if you could have an option on your site or Goodreads site where people can submit their books, their book groups / social clubs for others to search for. For instance, I have a science fiction book group at our library called Escape the Earth, and if it were listed on your site, which gets a lot of traffic from science fiction fans, it would bring my community closer together in our nerddom. Just a thought, but enjoying the podcast, Tyler."
Hey, Tyler, that's one of the great things about the Goodreads forum is you can start that thread. Just say, like, you know, list your book club here and start it in the general area. That'd be great. Mm-hmm. I think everybody would be interested if there's something in their area like that that they could go check out. So please do start the thread.
Also, I think it's nice that he thinks we have a lot of traffic on our website.
Yeah, I know. Probably don't have as much as maybe you think. But we do have a good, like, rabid community of people who are looking for like-minded folks. So that,
we do. That's
Jason in Australia says, "Hey, Tom and Veronica, congrats on the video show. I'd actually always hoped we'd see a video show, though I always imagined it would have been at Twit. Anyway, I have a couple thoughts. One, you mentioned the video show needing to be strictly PG. Do you feel this is going to have an impact on the book choices?" The answer is no. The book choices will still be the same book choices. We can't curse on the show. That doesn't mean the books can't have cursing in them. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Makes sense to me, yeah.
You can have a TV show on television in prime time that talks about movies that is PG, but the movies they talk about could be R-rated movies. Mm-hmm. Or we may have to check with YouTube. I believe they, when they say no cursing, they mean no putting curses on people. We'll double check on that. Question number two from Jason. What's going to happen with Game of Thrones TV discussion? I'd really like you to think about doing a separate small 10 to 15 minute audio show after each episode and drop them in the podcast feed. I think our Game of Thrones TV discussion will happen in small amounts on the YouTube show, but we will we'll keep that. Will be a major part of the audio podcast, I'm sure. Mm-hmm.
And then we have an email from Andrew who says, I know you can't talk about it on Sword and Laser because of your sponsor, but I think people should know about LibriVox.org. It's a website that is trying to record all public domain books into audiobooks and then publish them on the web under Creative Commons. People can volunteer to read books or chapters and upload them back to the site. They are all surprisingly well done, and although not on the same level as paid versions, they are very easy to listen to, unlike computer synthesized voices. I first heard about it from the Roku channel on the Nowhere Man's Privet channel page, which is at thenowhereman.com/Roku. I would love to know what you think about it. Thanks, Andrew.
Andrew, that doesn't violate, and we can talk about whatever we want as long as we're not actually talking about the part that's paid for by any particular sponsor. And I don't even think Audible would care about LibriVox.org. That's a, you know, public domain books and audiobooks. It's open source. It's all good. So I appreciate you sending that along. It's pretty cool.
Very cool. All right. Well, let's say hello to some new members. We have Jonathan.
Yep. Paul.
Courtney.
Mike.
Josh.
Scott.
Misha.
Tyler.
Brooke.
Yento.
G. Willow Wilson.
Brandon.
Carlene.
Leslie.
Amber.
Travis.
Kelly.
Hagar.
Vicky.
Terry.
Quentin.
Dan.
Quentin Coldwater. Is it Quentin Coldwater? Josh.
Gally.
Mike.
Rachel.
Phil.
Cameron.
Ryan.
Chase.
JC.
Frank.
Mike.
Louie.
Cy.
Nick.
John.
Trevor.
Sean.
Damien.
Hunter.
Gary.
Sam.
Jacob.
Hi.
Tony.
Philip.
Eric.
TK.
Will.
CF.
Jason.
Spiker.
Obi-Wan Spiker.
Obi-Wan Spiker.
Seymoura.
Lewis.
Tracy.
Mimsy.
Sarah.
Paul.
And John. Wow. Lots of folks.
Lots
welcome.
Lots of new folks. Welcome. Yeah.
Several of you said you found out about us from the Geek and Sundry announcement.
Woo-hoo!
So glad to have you along.
Man, that was a lot of people. And I don't know if our method is working anymore when it's that many people. Is it boring to listen to us just say your names?
Let us know. I mean, I'm sure if we said your name and your name's like Seymoura, you're like, that's awesome. Keep doing it. But that's a lot of people. We may have to come up with, we may have to get clever about this.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you want to get in touch with us, the email address is feedback@swordandlaser.com. The website is swordandlaser.com. All of our discussion happens over on Goodreads. And if you want to call us and leave a voicemail, which we will then play on the show, the phone number is 415-779-6736. That's 415-7-SWORD-6. We'll see you guys next time. You gonna say bye?
I did.
Oh, I didn't hear you.
I said, we'll see you later.
Okay, bye.
Bye.